You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where writers and readers meet.
And
story is everything.
We are delighted to be with you again tonight. We're your hosts, Bobby Jean and
Jim Bell.
And that, of course, is our opening music. Hot Texas Swing Band has allowed us to use Hot Texas to open and close this show. And we are so grateful to Alex Dormont for that. And we're just delighted to be back again this week.
Yes, we are.
We have had a week just living and listening to Johnny Cash.
We have.
This has been a Johnny Cash week. Yeah, who is our guest tonight?
Robert Book.
Sorry, Robert.
Robert Burke Warren.
There we go. Opening jitters. You know what that's like, Robert, right?
I know what that's like.
Definitely.
We are delighted to have him. He's just joined us on screen. Delighted to have you with us tonight. You are joining us
here.
From where? Where are you joining
us? I'm in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York. I am in my little office slash the nerve center of the house right here. I have a 4-bedroom 1910 Victorian house in the Catskills.
What a great place to be. Well, Jim has a little intro that he's just going to a teaser, because we want to hear more about you from you. But we are talking tonight with Robert Burke Warren. He is the editor of this fabulous new book, Cash on Cash. Take it away, Jim.
Okay. Robert Burke Warren is a writer, performer, teacher, musician, and the author of the novel Perfectly Broken and the one-man show Redheaded Friend. Tonight we'll be talking about his latest project, Cash on Cash, Interviews and Encounters with Johnny Cash. All right, Robert.
First off, Robert, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit more about your background and then how this book came to be?
Okay, sure. Yeah. Well, I've been a musician most of my life, and actually I've been a writer most of my life, but it's been in the last, I guess, 15 years or so that I've put more energy into writing and getting more writing gigs. But I've played in bands since I was 15. Since we moved up here, I've become a teacher as well, mostly of children. But I've done all kinds of teaching, from songwriting workshops to guitar lessons to bass guitar lessons. The book came about because a friend of my wife, Holly George Warren, also a writer and a friend of the show. A friend of ours, Ashley Kahn, he sent us a book that he did called Harrison on Harrison, which was part of the same series that my book is a part of. And it was interviews and encounters with George Harrison. And he sent it to us right about the beginning of the pandemic. And I really enjoyed it. I'm a Beatles fan. I'm more a Paul guy than a George guy. But still, I was really captivated by the format of the book, which was chronological interviews with George Harrison, dating all the way back to the earliest days of the Beatles up until just before his passing. And so you get a sense of the artist in their own words, as opposed to what a journalist or a writer thinks about them. I was playing bass in a touring rock and roll band, and we were grounded, needless to say, in March of 2020. Mm-hmm. And sometime, I think it was around late summer, I got curious and I went on the website of Chicago Review Press, publisher, to see what other books they had in the series. And they had a lot. They had Dolly on Dolly. They had Kurt Cobain on Kurt Cobain, mm-hmm. Judy Garland on Judy Garland. It was really a pretty broad mm-hmm. spectrum. Mm-hmm. Leonard Cohen on Leonard Cohen, Dylan on mm-hmm. Dylan. They had no Johnny Cash, which surprised mm-hmm. me mm-hmm. Because he is, I knew enough. I was a fan. I am a fan. I've been a longtime fan, even more of a fan since I did the book. But I know that there was a lot of substantive interviews with him going all the way back through the 70s, some in the 60s, so I wrote to the publisher and I said, you know, what do you think about Cash on Cash? And they said, well, send us a proposal. And in that proposal, tell us why you should be the one to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, give us your pitch, but include in that pitch, why you and nobody else. And that was not difficult for me because I mean, I've written a lot about music. I've done a lot of music journalism and music writing. But also I have played a lot of Johnny Cash songs and my pitch for the book was, you know, he's more than just the man in black, you know, and in the last 20 years or so since his passing, it's pretty fascinating how his music and his image have carried on in the age of the internet, mm-hmm. you know, as the age of the internet has really, really, ramped up in the last couple of decades. But what I have discovered as a fan is that most people have a really limited understanding of who he was, because they know who he was, but they don't realize that he wasn't just they have this inaccurate image of this mm-hmm. this, you know, dark you know outlaw preacher, you know, kind of, which is, you know, in one of the interviews in the book, he sort of takes responsibility for that himself. He's like, yeah, we, you know, I took part in pushing that image, but it's not me, you know, mm-hmm. There's a lot more to me. And I knew that from being a fan and knowing that he was a funny guy. And so anyway, I thought it would be really, great to put together, a book that would showcase that all these other aspects of his character, including his activism and his advocacy for, you know, prison reform, for Native Americans, for mm-hmm. Vietnam vets. You know, it's pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was my pitch, and they bit.
I got the gig. They said you're hired, or whatever the gig. They say.
I got the gig. And it was fun. It was took about a year, and it was a perfect thing to do during the pandemic for me because it entailed handling. You know, everything in the book is stuff you can't find on the internet. That was one of the, you know, stipulations of the book. Obviously, you don't. Why would you want to get the book if you can find? But you can't find this stuff on the internet. So I had to find stuff that hadn't been digitized, and it was great because that entailed going into archives at the Country Music Hall of Fame and going and finding collectors like eBay collectors and handling old magazines and newspapers and books, which was really therapeutic for me. You know, it was great. It was really wonderful. It was a very non-internet activity. It was great. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it.
Well, there's so much to talk about. It's hard to kind of decide what to dive into, but I will say just personally that this book was entertaining, engaging, enlightening, educational, especially if you don't know much or you think you don't know until you really get into this. And of course, you have found the interviews, but then you write introductions to those interviews that are written with such, I'll say, love, Robert, for lack of a better word. I mean, they're insightful and informative, and they help set that interview in its cultural time period or, you know, what was going on in his life. So you give us that kind of support to the interview, but you write with such, it's love. You write this book with love, and it comes out in every word, in every punctuation mark, in every new paragraph. It's
Thank
just
you.
Love is there. And I think, I don't know that I knew very much. I don't know that I had, I knew there was more to him. I never just thought he was, the man in black or the guy that sings in prisons or, but I really didn't, didn't know. So I was a blank chalkboard or sponge or whatever. And just, I just wanted more. I was sorry when there wasn't any more.
Well, thank you, Bobby. That's exactly, you're the perfect audience for it, because you know who he was. And like most people, it's kind of hard to not know who he was. This great American artist with these, he's an icon, and his songs are timeless and have become, part of the firmament of our culture, but the details, which are quite fascinating. But thank you for saying that about the intros, because that was very enjoyable for me. Because I knew that my readers, a lot of my readers are, most of my readers are like you guys, they know who he was, but they don't know the details. And I can get really, I enjoy getting sort of down down the rabbit holes. I mean, down the rabbit holes, and the details, and they fascinate me. They always have. And, but anyway, in the intros, I really want to just set the scene and give an idea to the reader of what was happening in Johnny Cash's life, but also what was happening in the background, in the culture, in the American culture and in pop culture. And because it is his story is punctuated by these very significant events in American culture, whether it's, the 50s, everything that came out of the boom that was Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry, the rock and roll boom that birthed so much music, including Johnny Cash. He was of that school, the class of 55, they call them. But then, of course, the 60s and everything that happened in the 60s, from the counterculture, which embraced him, and the Vietnam War, and then everything in the 70s from Watergate. We were talking the other day about how he attended the Watergate hearings. He was a patriot. He was raised with a great, great love of his country. He served, he was in the army. He served in, he was stationed in Germany, and it was peacetime, but he served, he wanted to serve. And then of course everything happened in the 70s with the ending of the Vietnam War, but then Vietnam vets. So this is, all these things are happening, and he is part of it. He's dug in to all of it. And he takes inspiration from things that are happening around him. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, sure.
You did a nice job of tying all that in. We agree. Were you under a time constraint to get the book written?
Yes, I had a deadline. Yes, and it was a good thing too. A deadline is a good thing. Although it's kind of a dirty word in this house, but nevertheless, yeah, I did. I had a deadline, and I had I had a word count.
A word count. Yeah. Okay. Now, how did you decide who did you want to? You're collecting the interviews, but how did you decide which ones you wanted to use? How many interviews did you have to look at? How many did you throw away? And that kind of thing.
I threw away a lot.
Yeah.
I tried to get one. I tried each one. I wanted to say something say something distinctive. They all had to be distinctive.
Okay.
And there had to be something about them that's made them stand apart from everything else. Some I couldn't get the rights to, You know, there were some where I had to track down who owns the copyright to it. And then I had to license them. And that was a whole new process for me. So some I couldn't afford. Playboy magazine wanted too much for one of their interviews. But it was a great interview though. I mean, it's hard to let that one go. Although I was really happy to find the one in Look magazine, which I was able to license, which came out within a couple of months of the Playboy one. It was all around, it was in the '60s. It's the late '60s. It's right around the time that the Johnny Cash show debuted. And that was a big watershed moment for him.
You know, Playboy's competition, Penthouse, didn't have any problem, you know.
They were super cool.
That was a great interview too.
Yeah, it is great. And it was like, I really loved going back to all these interviews in the '70s in particular. They were meaty and long, and it was a time when you could find a substantive, long, deep, detailed interview with someone who is a pop culture figure. And prior to the mid late 60s, that kind of coverage didn't really exist for, it's not until magazines like Crawdaddy and Rolling Stone who took a lot of inspiration from Playboy, for instance, because Playboy would have the Playboy interview, you know, and it was usually long. Usually they would have a couple of really, really detailed interviews in Playboy. But anyway, to answer your question, there was a fair amount that I couldn't, but I got everything that I wanted. When I got everything and stood back, I was really pleased that it was that the arc of his story was pretty clear. And, there was stuff from every decade of his work going. I mean, the earliest thing I think I have is from the late '50s. And then one of the interviews is from about 3 months before he passed.
Right. It is. I was impressed with him actually in the way he handled and talked in the interviews.
Yes.
He was very consistent in his thinking and his beliefs and kind of the direction he was going.
Yeah.
And from interview to interview, they might ask different questions, but basically the Johnny Cash was there. It didn't change any. And he was very articulate. I was impressed with that.
Yeah, incredibly articulate. I mean, he was a brilliant man. By all accounts, his father was quite the raconteur. Although a lot of it, I think his musical talent came from his mother. She played guitar and sang and taught him hymns when he was, some of his earliest memories are singing hymns with his mother. And but his father was. I mean, he was a pretty impressive dude himself. And he could have been a preacher. And Patrick Carr, there's a couple of interviews with Patrick Carr in the book. And he's a journalist who lives now in Tampa. But Patrick Carr also was the man who Cash hired when he did his second autobiography, Cash, in 1994. And I talked to Patrick Carr as often as I could get one of the writers to talk to me, if they're still alive, and if I can get them to talk to me, I would get them to talk to me so I could put their recollections in the introductions. Anyway, Patrick Carr said that when he sat down with Cash to do his autobiography with him in the 90s, that Cash spoke in prose. That's what he told me. He was like, Cash would open his mouth and everything that came out was this really finely wrought, perfectly formed sentence and beautiful.
I remember that.
You know, and just the gift of a storyteller. But he was from storytelling stock, you know, but you're right. That was one of the reasons why I was kind of surprised that no one had jumped on it before me, is because he is so incredibly articulate in these interviews, and you can get a sense of his voice and what it was like to hang out with him. you know, that was part of the impetus for wanting to do the book.
When you looked at interviews and had thoughts about choosing, were you also thinking about interviews that would show us other sides of him, or would open up our understanding of that he wasn't a one-sided, or he was just, like we were saying earlier, the man in black, that you were really looking to give us a full round picture of this really amazingly talented man?
Yes. Yes. The answer is yes. I didn't have to look very far, because you, especially in the '70s, he's funny.
Yeah, he's funny. Like
really, he's really funny.
That's true.
And, you know, he's, and in one of the, and whenever there's something in some levity or like he's joking around, he got to know a lot of these journalists. You know, they became, I wouldn't say friends, but they became sort of peers. And yeah, he would be shooting the breeze with them. And he was very candid. Mm-hmm. He was not really very guarded. It mm-hmm. was the thing, you know, I will say he played his cards close to the vest when they would ask him about his politics.
Mm-hmm.
He was like,
yes,
several times in the '70s, they're like, so, cause it was such a seismic time politically, you know, where there was, I was just talking to my son about this the other day, you know, it was like, you know, you went from, you know, Nixon's two terms and then his resignation. And then from that, you get Jimmy Carter, who's the polar opposite, and all this stuff is happening in the background and he's engaged in all of it. And part of it is, in one interview, is he says is that Jimmy Carter is a distant relative of June Carter.
June, mm-hmm.
They're somehow cousins.
Yeah.
but anyway, they're like, you know, what do you think about Gerald Ford, you know, and everything. But although he did play at the Nixon White House. Interesting. He's fascinating. He played the Nixon White House but he wouldn't play what Nixon asked him to play.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, he was very outspoken against the Vietnam War at the same time. And he's hobnobbing with counterculture, but he's also going on crusades with Billy Graham.
Billy Graham.
I mean, they were super, super tight, and he never, ever backed down from any of that. He never apologized for any of it or anything. He's like, I'm a Christian, and I want to go out with Billy Graham and spread the good news. And he and June did a lot of that. And so he's a very complex, fascinating guy. But yeah, anytime I could find something where he would reveal something, or where I could get the interviewers to tell me something about what it was like in his presence,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then that was always a something I strove to do in the book.
Well, when you talked about the White House, the Nixon White House, and appearing there, and I don't recall if it was in your introduction to a particular interview or if it came out in the interview, but the comment that I walked away with is, it's the office of the president. And if you're asked or you're invited, it isn't who's the president, it's the office of the president. And you honor the office of the president. So it's not really political whether I, you know, like you or not as president.
Yeah.
And then the reasons, you know, it was so interesting. The two songs that they wanted was Okie from Muskogee and
Welfare Cadillac.
Yeah. And he's like, you know, the first one's by Merle Haggard. I'm not going to sing it. That wouldn't be appropriate, you know? Yeah. So interesting, because we might have this image of, oh, you know, he went and played at the White House, but to understand the whole dynamic of that,
yeah,
you know, yeah, it's just fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Yeah, he did it in his own way. But yes, that is, it wasn't in my intro, but he does say something in one of the interviews that's exactly what he said.
Yeah,
you know, and it was really important to him to take his dad. I mean, the relationship he had with his father was very complex, and fraught, you know, but at the same time, he was, you know, he really wanted to do that for his pop, you know, and, but yeah, that was Johnny Cash's opinion as well, is that it's the office. Mm-hmm. And, but I think I have always thought it was, you know, interesting. And there's a whole documentary film made about just the visit to the White House.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, it's really good. but wherein they talk about, you know, that whole thing of them wanting him to play specific songs and him just saying, no, sir. I'm actually going to play my own songs.
Yeah. You know?
But anyway, so, but yeah, that was one thing that I, you know, you couldn't really pin him down on anything. Yeah. He was complex, you know.
We are talking with Robert Burke Warren, and we're talking about this fascinating book, Cash on Cash, which is available through the Out West Shop affiliate bookshop.org page. We're going to take a very brief message moment here, Robert. And when we come back, we want to tell more stories.
Okay, I got some more.
Okay, we'll be right back.
Okay.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with Robert Warren.
Cash on Cash. You need to get a copy right away.
Yeah, you do. It was fun to put together. It really was a fun gig.
You know, his meeting with Sun Records, you know, with Sam Phillips, and that was really kind of the start, wasn't it? It sure was for a lot of other folks.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the way the whole Sun Records thing came about is just very inspiring, but also very telling, you know, it's very telling how he grew up in Dias, Arkansas when he was four, his father was able to get them in on the only planned agrarian community that the Roosevelt administration put together. It was kind of an experiment where they gave them acreage and livestock and seed and a house, because his father had been a farmer, but it was the depression and his farmer was out of work and they were really struggling. And, but his farmer was a vet, a decorated vet, and just, you know, was able to, you had to apply and you had to pass muster, and his father was able to get him, into this community. And that's where he grew up farming, mostly cotton, but also soybeans and a couple other things, but it was hard scrabble life. But he went to, what were you going to say, Jim?
I was going to say, you know, right with what you're saying is he actually spent 8 hours a day or more in the fields picking cotton. So he really came from a pretty basic background.
Dirt poor. And the backbreaking work. Yeah. And when he was little, he would sing. Apparently he had a really high voice when he was a little boy. It's really hard to imagine, but he would sing, and he would carry water to the workers in the field, to his brothers and his father. And it was hard. His mother was a real source of love for him. He was very tight with his mother. But anyway, what I was going to say is that, you know, he didn't want to stay there though. You know, he wanted to leave, and he did briefly work in an auto factory. He went up north, I think, just for a couple of weeks, got on the assembly line and worked. You know, I think it was the GM. I think the GM or the
Pontiac.
The GM.
I thought it was Pontiac.
You're right, Bobby.
When you do the interview about one piece at a time, and then it kind of.
It was Pontiac.
This early part of his life.
You're right.
For like a month or something.
Right. Yeah. And he was like, "I don't, this is terrible.
Like, I'm done here."
Yeah. So then he enlisted. Then he enlisted, and he when he was in the Army, in the Air Force, excuse me, the Army Air Force. But the he was a radio operator, and actually he, this is a little interesting tidbit. He is the first American to learn of the death of Joseph Stalin. His job was to monitor transmissions coming from the Iron Curtain, from the other side of the Iron Curtain, and relay those to his superiors. And he did that for years, actually. But he had a gift for being able to perceive certain signals in the air through headphones. And so that's mainly what he did for, I think, 3 years. And anyway, so he moved back to Arkansas, but he didn't want to stay there. And his brother had moved to Memphis. And his brother said, "Why don't you move to Memphis?" And Cash had just gotten married to his first wife, Vivian, and Vivian Liberto. And he moved to Memphis to get a job. He didn't move there to be a musician or anything. He had played a little bit of guitar when he was in the Air Force, and had a little group and everything, but he didn't really take it very seriously. But anyway, Elvis Presley happened around the time that he moved to Memphis. Mm-hmm. And he heard about Sun Records, and he said, "Well, you know, I want to be a gospel singer. I think maybe I could do this because they love hearing me sing gospel songs, you know, in the Air Force." Yeah. and so he goes to Sun Records, and Sam Phillips won't see him and puts him off not once, not twice, but three times. And he keeps going back and keeps going back and keeps going back. And finally he catches Sam Phillips in a good mood, because Sam Phillips is quite busy actually with Elvis Presley. But Sam Phillips finally is like, "Okay, this handsome 6'2" guy, you know, maybe he's got something." And he played him a gospel song, and Sam Phillips was like, "That's not going to work. I can't sell gospel. You got anything else?" And then he comes back a couple of weeks later with a couple of car mechanic friends of his who became the Tennessee Two.
Amazing story.
Marshall Grant and Luther Perkins. They put music to a poem that he had written called "Hey Porter." And he had been writing poems since he was a little kid. He was a word guy, you know, he was a poet, and he had been writing poems since he was a little kid. And he wrote this poem called "Hey Porter," which was about the excitement of coming home to the South after being away. And anyway, so that was his first single. Sam Phillips heard that, and he was like, "Okay, that's it. You know, that I can sell." So that was the beginning. And, you know, as soon as he got his shot, he got better and better and better and better. And within a year, he wrote and recorded Folsom Prison Blues and and "I Walk the Line." I Walk the Line was his third single, and that was his breakthrough, you know. And it was from then on, that was his ticket to that put him on the charts with like Frank Sinatra, and you know, and really, I mean, Folsom Prison Blues was a hit, but it was only a hit on country radio. But "I Walk the Line" crossed over to the pop charts. Mm-hmm. And changed his life. Mm-hmm. You know, that was it.
There's conversation in the book about Nashville wanting crossovers, and it was maybe even later in his career. And you know, before that time, just like you just said, everybody was on the same chart. I mean, you could have Sinatra, Perry Como, you know, whatever. They were all on the same chart. I don't know when that began to be distributed differently, but you know, "I Walk the Line" was a crossover, but he didn't really mean it to be. I mean, it was just great music. And I know in one interview he talked a little bit about some concerns actually that Nashville was looking for music to be able to cross over, and that meant that a lot of really great music was maybe not was being denied, wasn't right. being allowed. And I thought yeah. that's just so he's right there through all of these changes that happen. And yeah. we see it through the eyes of somebody who really knows the industry and knows the craft. Interesting that he was really following so many other songwriters. Of course, yeah. we enjoyed all the references to Bob Dylan. We had no idea that I want to read Dylan on Dylan because I know nothing about Bob Dylan. And if there's a yeah. Dylan on Dylan that's like this book, I'm there.
it is. That one is really comprehensive. It's about twice as long as mine.
Oh, my.
Yeah, they didn't give him a word count like they gave me. But it's fine.
But fascinating, his friendship with Bob Dylan
yeah.
and Kris Kristofferson, the two that we found the most, tell us, yeah. Share a Bob Dylan story with us, if you could.
Oh, wow. Well, Bob Dylan changed Johnny Cash's life. There was a mutual admiration society going
on. Yes, it was. But you're right.
The charts started turning, they started becoming more, specialized in the 50s, and there was a pop chart, and there was the folk chart. But anyway, Bob Dylan invited Johnny Cash, who Johnny Cash had his first flush of fame, and then things calmed down a little bit, and then he had a bit of a comeback with I Walk the Line. Ring of Fire.
Ring of Fire.
Okay. Ring of Fire. That was when June Carter co-wrote that song with Merle Kilgore, a songwriter named Merle Kilgore. And Johnny Cash had a crush on June Carter and really wanted, they were both married to other people, and it was very sort of a lot of drama. But he really wanted her in his band. And, so he invited, and he said, the only way I can get her to be in my band is if I invite her whole family to be in my band. And so that's what he did. So it was June Carter and her sisters. And I think, and Maybelle was part of the, Mother Maybelle was part of the troupe for a while. He was like, this is, but anyway, so she wrote that song and he started to Bob Dylan reached out to him in 1964 when Bob Dylan was just starting to gain fame as the great white hope of folk music. And it was before he went electric. He was still considered this folk icon. And so he was headlining the Newport Folk Festival, and he invited Johnny Cash to the Newport Folk Festival. And people were like, the country guy? And he's like, yeah, the country guy. He's the real deal. He's like, you have Hank Williams, you have the Carter family, you have Jimmy Rogers, and you have Johnny Cash. He is the next link in that chain. And Bob Dylan was a scholar of mm-hmm. American folk music, and folk music of the British Isles. He did his homework. He didn't just come out of nowhere. He said that when he first heard Johnny Cash, it was like hearing a voice from the center of the earth. So anyway, he invites Johnny Cash to the Newport Folk Festival, and Johnny Cash just slays. He goes up there and apparently gives like this legendary performance, and was embraced by what was then the beginnings of the counterculture. And they stayed with him, and that was another thing that I noticed about Johnny Cash. I knew this about him even before I did the book, is that I don't think he is equaled in the broad spectrum mm-hmm. that he commands of fans. You got the hippies. He called them the long-haired element. That's how he refers.
So
you have them, and then you have conservative Christians, and you have punk rockers and rock and rollers, and you have people who love really hard, dark, heavy metal music. They love him. It goes on and on and on and on and on. Old people, young people, children. Mm-hmm. There's something about, I play Johnny Cash songs for children all the time, and they are, I'm talking 2, 3, 4 year old kids, and they love him. They love his songs. But anyway, so yes, and he was a, not just a great songwriter, but he was a great song interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, part of the folk tradition as well, is that you do, you don't just, you know, prior to Bob Dylan, it was, you know, you would learn, part of your show would not just be about your own personal songs. You would have to go to the canon of great American folk music and learn your Jimmy Rogers songs, learn your Carter Family songs. You know, you learn the Hank Williams songs, and that's part of your repertoire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, but anyway, so he loved, and Kris Kristofferson, you know, he loved that man's songs. And there's a Native American writer, Peter LaFarge, who he loved, and you know, recorded a lot of Peter LaFarge's songs.
Now, Robert, I'm looking at time, and we're in case Sam is listening. Sam, we're not doing any more spots because we don't want to miss any more time with Robert. but you just mentioned Kris Kristofferson, and we only I'm looking. It's like we have 4 minutes left to talk to you, Robert. Five minutes in the tops. Yeah, we're gonna have to have you back. There's just no way. And of course, we are big Kristofferson fans, especially Jim. I've learned about Chris through Jim's interest, and of course, you have to tell the story about the helicopter.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that is recounted in the book. When I found that interview, I was like, I'm whatever it costs, I'm paying for this one. Anyway, yeah. So Kris Kristofferson came from a military family and had been he was expected to have a life in the military like his father before him, and he was a teacher at West Point and decided he didn't want to do that anymore. He wanted to be a songwriter, so he moved to Nashville. Disowned by his family. They were not happy about that decision. And he got a job as a janitor in a recording studio which was frequented by not only Johnny Cash, but a lot of other country stars. But they told him, if you give any, they knew he was a songwriter, his bosses at the recording studio, they said, if you give any of your songs to anybody who comes in here, you're fired. Nevertheless, June Carter took a shine to Kris Kristofferson, and, and he would slip tapes to June, and she would give them to Johnny. He wouldn't listen to him. And so Kris Kristofferson had done a tour of duty in Vietnam and knew how to fly a helicopter. So he somehow commandeered a helicopter and flew it to Hendersonville, Tennessee, where Johnny Cash and June Carter lived, and landed it in their backyard. And so Johnny Cash just taking a nap. June comes to him and says, John, you have to wake up. There's some fool has landed a helicopter in our backyard. You have to go deal with this. And Johnny Cash is furious. His nap had been interrupted. So he goes out in the back, and apparently Kris Kristofferson steps out of the helicopter and walks up to him and hands him a cassette and says, sir, I would really appreciate it if you'd listen to my songs. And depending on who you talk to, because there's different versions of this part of the story, but Sunday Morning Coming Down was on the cassette. Johnny Cash says Sunday Morning Coming Down was on the cassette, and he listened to it, and that is a incredible song. And he's like, I'm going to record the song, and it was a hit. So that was the first song that Cash recorded by Kris Kristofferson, but also he took Kris Kristofferson on the road with him, and he was like, I think you can be a performer. And Kristofferson was like, no, I don't think so. I think I just want to be a songwriter. He's like, no, you're a performer. So he gave him a career as a performer, which led to him being, you know,
he took him to the Newport Folk Festival, didn't he? And Kris Kristofferson was going to go out and sing, but he wouldn't move. He was frozen.
June he said, get out there.
It was June. It was June.
Kicked him in the rear end.
Kicked him in the butt. Got him out, literally kicked him in the butt and got him out on the stage. Yes. So that was that's just one of many great stories.
This book is just teeming with all kinds of stories. Like the ones that we're sharing. We could talk to you, Robert, for hours and be totally entertained.
I wish I had my, I do a show. I do, when I do my book events, I play songs and I tell these stories, and it's pretty great. And it does go on for like at least an hour and a half.
Well, you say that you do a question and answer kind of period. Have you ever had a crazy question that somebody's thrown to you? What's the craziest question you've ever had?
There was a guy who was there was a guy at one of the events who asked me a question that didn't make any sense. You know, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he was very passionate. I have found people are very passionate about Johnny Cash, but anyway, he just stood up. I don't know if he was inebriated or not, but he just sort of mumbled some stuff, and I was like, I don't know, sir. But thank you for your question. Thank you for your input,
Robert. Anyway. Where can people find you? You write a really interesting blog. Where can they find you? Where can they get the book? Fill us in on that.
Okay, you can get the book on all the major platforms. You can go to your local bookseller, and if they don't have it, they can order it. You can go to Amazon. You can go to BarnesandNoble.com. You can go to Bobby and Jim Bell's shop and get it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you can find me. Yeah, I have a blog that I write on Substack. It's called Robert Burke Warren Show Folk. And I'm also on Facebook and Instagram. And you just put my name in there, and there's only one Robert Burke Warren, and that's me.
And Burke is with an E on the end of it.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
This has been so much fun.
This is a lot of fun.
So just stay with us, Robert. We're going to kind of do our traditional little wrap up here, but we were just delighted to see your face in the same room with us.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you guys. Thank you.
It's really, really fun. Next week, we have author Johnny Bernhard back on the writer's block. Every time she had out a new book, we had her on with us. We're really looking forward to having her with us with her new book, Hannah and Aurelia. And we want to thank Robert Burke Warren again for being with us tonight. For everybody that is listening live, maybe you're on the Facebook stream or you're listening off of LA Talk Radio, you're listening to the audio, we really thank you for being with us tonight, or you might be listening to this months from now. We appreciate that. And we want to say a thank you to Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio. And to Alex Dormont once again in the Hot Texas Swing Band. And you have a great quote for tonight.
Well, we found a quote here from this great book we were just reading.
Yeah.
From Johnny Cash, who says, "All your life you will be faced with a choice. You can choose love or hate. And I choose love."
Yeah.
There you go. That's good.
We were worried. We were going to run out of time, and now we have a couple minutes. So, Robert, do you have a project you're working on next? Do you have something coming up at all?
I've been doing a lot of, since March of this last year, I've been doing a lot of performing. I'm a performer as well as a writer. I just recently did a David Bowie tribute show in honor of his birthday. And actually, when my book came out, I did a whole set of Johnny Cash songs with my band. And, going forward, I am always working on something on writing. I have a novel that's already been published, but I'm working on another one. And I'm always writing on my blog as well. But yeah, I've always got performances coming up. I have a Leonard Cohen tribute coming up in April.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to be traveling to Chicago to do to promote this book, and doing some more events around here in the Northeast. And I'm always trying to stay out of trouble. that's the novel that I'm working on. I really want to get that done. The timing of everything went cattywampus, as we say in the South, with COVID. But I've just, it's been playing a lot of catch up in this last year, and it's been really wonderful, to get out and be with people again. So I've been making up for lost time because I didn't perform inside a venue on the
right.
in 2.5 years.
Yeah.
That was rough for me.
Well, on behalf of Jim and me and Robert Burke Warren for being with us tonight, till we meet again next week, remember.
It's always a great day. Out west.
Out west. See you till next week.
Thanks, y'all.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.